right?
So I'm going to try to give a just an abbreviated summary of what I initially intended to do, but I think we, you know, we covered a lot in that discussion and question and answer about attention and mindfulness. But the place I want to start was with Socrates. And he said, when you're looking for something but don't know quite what it is, how do you know when you've found it? So I think this has a lot to do with practice, because unless we have in some very concerted way studied the Dharma in an orderly fashion, you know, we're introduced to these kind of discrete pieces of it, and we're not quite sure how they fit together, how they interact with each other, and we know it has something to do with dampening down our suffering and being more happy. But in some more concrete, systematic way, we don't know. And the extraordinary thing, I think, about the teachings of the historical Buddha is how clear and orderly they are. And, you know, that's, at least for most of us, that's not a good description of our internal life, how clear and orderly it is. But the teachings do provide this structure and then this enormous space with which to work with all the chaos and confusion and difficulty of our internal life. But that structure is so valuable in terms of keeping our mind pointed in a particular direction and staying on track. So before we go to attention and mindfulness, I think what we need to do is go absolutely all the way back to the beginning, and that is, how does consciousness and perception arise? Because if we don't have consciousness and perception, we don't have attention and mindfulness, right? And this is part of the, and I'm abbreviating this because this can be a very long discussion, but I'm really trying to focus on some core ideas here. This is at the absolute core of all of the Buddhist teachings. And it is this element that we were talking about a little while ago, about how things come together. And when they come together, certain things appear, arise. And then when those things don't come, when those dissipate or they don't come together, either things dissipate or they never arise in the first place. And that can be accurately said from a Buddhist perspective, that is the nature of all experience of every single kind. And we all can test that on our own. So, you know, the next walking period, you can go out and you can walk a little bit and then look up at the tree and see what happens. You know, well, does a thought come into your mind? Do you feel something? Does nothing happen? You know, test it out. You know, that's what the Buddha said. Try all of this out. This is not a question of belief. So, from a Buddhist perspective, there are six sense doors, six senses, and then there are, quote, sense objects or things that relate to that sense. So, you know, we have the ability to smell, and then there are smells, right? And then when our ability of this sense door to or connects with that odor, something happens, right? Until they're connected. Like if I'm at my house in Campus Commons and someone has a very pungent vegetable in their salad and is eating it in the lunchroom, I'm probably not going to have much reaction to it. Right? Because why? there's no contact between my nose and that odor, right? But if I'm sitting at the next table and it's very strong, and that odor comes up and it connects with my sense door, and my sense door is not damaged, so in fact I can smell, that moment of contact, two things, actually three things, but I'm just going to start with two. Two things from a Buddhist perspective immediately happen. First thing is that consciousness arises, fundamental awareness, which was not there when I was sitting in Campus Commons. The second thing that arises is perception. Perception, in this context, meaning this instinctive ability that the mind has to distinguish and categorize things. So I know that's a smell, not a bird. Or if I'm out walking and I hear the chirp of a bird, and that connects with this sensor in my ear, immediately what arises is the consciousness of that chirp and the perception that the mind just instinctively does, if it has a big enough catalog of, well, that's some kind of bird, not a smell. Okay? So from a Buddhist perspective, there isn't a unitary consciousness. And this is critical to understanding the Buddha's idea of suffering, and also to the idea that we talk about of quote, depersonalizing things, or dampening down the passion, I mean, in a negative sense of things. Okay? So the Buddha's theory, and once again you can test this out on your own, is that there are actually six different kinds of consciousness. There's a consciousness associated with smelling, with hearing, with seeing, with tasting, okay, and the mind being the sixth sense door, you know, where thoughts arise. Okay. So where we get in trouble is that the mind combines these and treats them as unitary and then creates a solidity. You know, so rather than saying that a smell has arisen, it connected with my sense doors and my nose, and so sense consciousness arose and I have perception, seeing the dynamic nature of that, that it's momentary and it's contingent on that contact, goes right by that, right? So I'm in the lunchroom, I smell something, I don't like it. Or I'm in the lunchroom, I smell something, I really like it. That's it, right? I mean, immediately go to the result of the coming together and the arising. Go completely by the arising itself. Okay? And then you can just apply that across the board, and then we get to the real, you know, problematic things of troubling thoughts and comments by other people, and boom, you know, it's like immediately I'm into results and reacting to the results rather than looking at the coming together. So this is what the Buddha meant by looking at the surface of things rather than the depth, meaning the underlying process of coming together that causes that thing to be there and you to react to. So that we're walking around all the time caught in our reactivity, disassociated from the arising and the becoming. Okay? At least theoretically, does that work? It's really important, because the reason that we talk about staying in our bodies and the experience of our bodies is to go back to the coming together and the arising. That's the reason we do that. Because if we don't, the reactivity is associated with what? By definition, content. Right? Story, he said, she said, I don't like that, I can't believe you did that. If I don't get to the T-ball diamond on time, you know, my grandchild's going to be irrevocably damaged. But it's all content. So once, as we were saying earlier, once you take the underlying process out, the only thing you're left with is content. And then when you're left with content, somehow you've got to solve that. And when you're with content, it's emotion-based and idea-based. So now we're going to get lost in ideas, and you've got to figure out how to order the ideas and work with the ideas. There's all kinds of wonderful processes for that. But the Buddha's theory was that's we're heading in the wrong direction. It's so much suffering to go there. Let's start at the origin of things and work with them at that level. So in Asia, if you are practicing at one of the serious retreat centers and you're out walking in the forest, you have this opening, this incredible opening about your father or your mother or your wife or your husband or your partner or something, and you go in and report it to your teacher. You don't go in and report, geez, I had this unbelievable opening about my father or my mother or my husband or my wife or my partner. You go in and say, you have to see it. But you're supposed to be practicing in a way that you go in and say, a series of things came together, and that caused an insight to arise about my mother. The focus of the interview is not about the insight and how this is now going to change my whole life and I'm going to relate to women differently for the rest of my life. That's not the focus of the interview. The focus of what was the thing that caused that to arise? What were the conditions that caused that to arise? Okay. So this is core, and the nature of consciousness, awareness of the nature of perception are momentary in the sense that these things come together and they arise and then they change and they're gone. Okay. And they are contingent in the sense that those conditions have to be together in a particular way in order for that particular thing to happen, which includes reactivity, by the way. We've got this storehouse with all these deep habits in it. They're just waiting to be activated. Something happens. Those come together, that arises. And then at that moment, if we could see it, we have a choice. Most of the time, because we are not training ourselves to look for that, we don't see it. We start having reactive thoughts and emotions, and we pick it up, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 generations of reactivity down. And then it's really hard to do anything about. And the idea of then going back to the arising and the coming, it's impossible. Can't do it. Okay. So this is the reason that if you take, any beginning Buddhist meditation program in any tradition, it starts with what's happening in your breath and your body. And discerning the difference between how a thought feels, an emotion feels, a sensation feels. That's the reason. Is to focus the mind into this fundamental level and causation. Now, there is a third thing that arises simultaneously with the arising of consciousness and perception. Okay, so does anybody have any idea what that is? Yes. Excuse me?
A body sensation?
Well, it can express itself that way. But it's close.
You said
vedana.
That's right. Vedana. Feeling tone. Mm-hmm. And in Buddhist practice, when we talk about feeling, we don't mean like an emotion. We mean simultaneously with the arising of consciousness and a non-unitary consciousness. So I'm gonna do it with the arising of hearing consciousness. And my perception that that's actually a bird. There is a feeling tone to those two things. Okay, it's coloring it or influencing it. It's what consciousness and perception are being held in. is a feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And this is so important, and I think for most of us, honestly, most of us aren't paying a lot of attention to that because it's a way of training the mind. It is so important. It is one of the four foundations of mindfulness. I mean, those three little things, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, for the Buddha, were a whole category equal to, for discrete treatment, as the body and the breath, everything that happens in the mind, and all the fundamental teachings, dependent origination, the Eightfold Path, right? So, you know, if you create a chart of the Eightfold Path, and I think, not the Eightfold Path, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and I think I handed this out 2 months ago, you know, there's four boxes. The second box, you know, the first box is, I don't know, like seven different meditations on the body. The third box is everything that happens in the mind. The fourth box is the Eightfold Path, dependent origination, all these things, right? These, right? And the second one is three things: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's it. You know, a lot of people even forget that that's one of the major foundations of mindfulness. Okay. And so that's the third thing that arises simultaneously. And why is that so important? Because it is the thing that, it is the primary condition that starts to trigger or activate deep habits of mind that are in the storehouse of built-up habits that we call mental formations. Okay? So if we don't catch that, if we go by pleasant or unpleasant, that starts to escalate. And it goes to desire or aversion, and then attachment, and then identification, and I'm lost. Okay. So I think everything is great. I planned it out. Even changing my grandson, he loves it so much. There's a whole game with that. That takes a half hour just to get him changed. I mean, I get him in the back seat, happy as a clam. I drive up to that stoplight, right? And I see that I'm going to be at that stoplight. That stoplight's going to change five times before I even move once, okay? And, you know, this thing explodes in my mind, right? Okay. So the quicker, if I could be body-based and see this thing starting to come up and say, man, that's really unpleasant. At that point, it's so fast, it's not only unpleasant. I mean, it's really aversive. But if I could catch that, I've got the ability to work with it right away. If I wait until it kind of explodes and I'm using words and my grandson's saying, Poppy, you're not supposed to be saying that. Which was what happened the other night. If it's at that point, I've gone all the way through, right? It's gone up to aversion, and then that aversion has made me just completely clamp down on this principle that something is wrong and bad is going to happen, and it's happening to me. It's also happening in him, but it's happening to me. That's the reason I'm so pissed off. Well, you know, you've gone through the whole chain of dependent origination. So the reason that we try to get people as much as possible to be more and more and more body-based, and in mindfulness-based stress reduction, for example, the first 3 weeks of homework are all a body scan of the body to start becoming really, really intimate with the body, is that the sooner that you can actually feel this in a non-conceptual way, not making a story about it, just feeling this thing coming up, you can open to it. If you can open to it, that tends to reduce the intensity of it. You've got the basis of working with it, okay? So this, and so work, we haven't even, you know, this explanation is before attention and before mindfulness, These three things arise. They're that critical to everything in Buddhist practice. Okay. And so the reason that this is so important is that, number one, to the degree that we can even start to get a taste of this, we can start to understand the very nature of experience itself. We normally don't think of it this way, but this is the way that all experience arises. All experience. So experience actually isn't a mystery. This is the framework where we can understand the mechanism of how it arises, and then through attention, we can start pointing our attention towards this early stage of coming together, and then with mindfulness, we can open to it and experientially investigate it. Okay? So this explains the fundamental nature of all experience. The second thing it does, as I mentioned earlier, is that if to the degree we can do it, it depersonalizes. Another way of saying this is it breaks down the reactivity to this, because it is non-conceptual. You know, it's like, what conditions came together? I can feel that in my body, right? So it's non-conceptual. And it is not content-based. Okay, I'm sitting at that stoplight, and that thing starts coming up. It's like, okay, well, what is that? You know, it's this raw thing happening in my body. I can go to it. I can open to it. I can feel the intensity. I can bring some kindness to it. And that'll just start dropping it all down. No content there. And I'm not going, gee, the reason I'm feeling this way is I'm going to be late. It's nothing. Like, I'm in my body. I'm in that thing that's coming up. And so I can respond to it in a non-conceptual, non-story-based content way. And then I can really dampen it down. With really powerful things, you can do that, and the story's still there. Then you can deal with the story in a pretty effective way without feeling like you're sitting on a volcano or that you're out of control or that it's chaotic. Okay. So I saw a lot of the Buddhist magazines now have like a forum, and they'll have like two or three or four teachers, and there will be an issue or a topic or a question, and then... And usually it's teachers from different traditions, you know, to kind of give you the flavor that each one wanted to bring to it. So I saw one of these recently, and the topic was a young man wrote in and he said, I feel like I've become addicted to pornography. And even when I sit down to meditate, I keep thinking about pornography while I'm meditating, you know, and basically, well, you know, what should I do with this? And, you know, it was really a heartfelt thing. You know, he was just saying, this is, I feel shame, and I feel guilt for doing it. I feel shame for thinking that there's something wrong with me, and, you know, the whole thing. So each one of them had different comments about what they might do, but the fundamental thing that jumped out at me that's consistent with what I've just been saying is that each one of them basically said, you know, the real problem is not the content. You know, the real content is not the pornographic content. You know, you think that that's what the problem is. But good dharma is about reframing what the issue or the problem is from a dharmic perspective. And they said that the content is not the real problem, although, you know, you have to deal with it. The real problem is this deep habit of mind of going to that for a particular reason. You know, that there are some conditions, you know, anxiety, fear, exclusion from a group, you know, there are all these potential things that are very, very powerful, which are triggering the habit of mind of using the pornography as a form of release. And that's where you need to go to first. So that, you know, that's where we are. Conditions come together. Well, start watching. Well, when do I want to go to the computer and hit the pornographic sites. Start watching that. And what does that feel like? And then, as the Dalai Lama says, and my favorite quotation from the Dalai Lama is, it's not very long, and he just says, what we should do is look at what happens just before we suffer. That's where we should practice. And this is what he means. What are the conditions? Right? Like, okay, I want to go to the computer to look at this. Okay, what's going on? What am I feeling right now? Okay, feeling really, really anxious. Why am I feeling really, really anxious? Feeling really, really anxious because I just had a telephone call. So, keep getting back to real basics and getting back to this coming together issue. Okay, so with that as a foundation, we can get to attention and mindfulness. So, I think, William James said that, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but it's a great quote. He said, the ability to voluntarily bring back a wandering attention and again, is the very root of judgment, character, and will. That's kind of an amazing quote, because he says it's the very root of judgment, character, and will that the bringing back is. Okay, so, well, why would that be? And it's, you know, what we started with during that go-around is that our mind so frequently is not staying on the attentional object that we want it to be on, that we can't concentrate our mind, the mind can't calm down, we can't see clearly and fully what's before us, because we're missing so much, right? And we can't conduct sustained experiential investigation. We can't keep our attention there and open to what's happening in my body, what does that feel like, what's happening in my mind, right? So if we think of attention as the, you know, directional force, you know, I'm going to point my mind in a particular direction, and then the focusing, you know, very tightly or opening, then developing the skill to be able to do that the way we want to is the difference between our mind being on things that are dramatic, but we really don't want our attention there, and having our attention where we want our attention to be. So it's a question of choice, okay? And then mindfulness, there's, you know, a lot of different definitions of this, and I'm sure you've seen the Satipatthana Sutra and, you know, Joseph Goldstein's book, which I think, if you ever get serious about really understanding it, is the best thing out in a non-technical form. Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's got to be 380, 400 pages, you know. But in general, you know, mindfulness is a particular quality of mind that is moment to moment or here and now present, that is non-judgmental, that's the core of it, and that is kind, and that is equanimous. You know, those. And so, when we talk about, you'll hear people say, and you'll hear the Buddha say in the suttas, that mindfulness is, quote, bare attention. He does not mean bare in the sense of, well, it's just sensory awareness. That's all. It's bare sensory awareness. He's using the term bare to mean it is not contaminated with anything that has been added onto it. A judgment, an emotion, a conceptualization. You're just seeing the thing itself without adding anything onto it. That's bare attention. So, this is where I think this is a confused point for many people, because you'll hear, you know, there's the a lot of different versions of this, but basically there's two monks from different schools. They're walking down a river and they meet, and You know, they both stop and with their knapsack and have a little bite to eat, and the talk turns to each one of their teachers, you know, the monk who's the head of the monastery. And the one monk says, young monk says, that, you know, my teacher's unbelievable. You know, my teacher can see past lives. And my teacher can transport himself, his consciousness, to other. And basically, you know, in the suttas, there's supposedly there's these qualities of a fully enlightened mind. And he lists those off. And so he finishes, and you can tell this is a very prideful report by this young monk. So then, and then he says, well, what about your teacher? And the other young monk, the same thing, says, oh, you know, my teacher's unbelievable. And he's incredible. And the first monk says, well, why? And he says, well, when he eats, he just eats. And when he walks, he just walks. And when, you know. So a lot of people hear that as well. It's this very kind of simplistic sensory awareness based thing. And you can be sure what it does not mean is that if the one teacher, the head of the monastery, puts something hot in his mouth and it's burning his mouth, he doesn't just go, oh, burning. You know, it's like, no, you know, there's a recognition of it, and there is a recognition of the relationship to harm and suffering, and you do something about it. Okay, so this is the purposefulness aspect of mindfulness, that it sees into the nature of experience, this coming together, and the relationship of that coming together, this arising, and suffering and happiness. This is the thing that delineates the Buddhist teaching, and this is what Buddhist mindfulness is. It's not just, I feel sun on my arm. It's like, I feel sun on my arm. That's really soothing. I recognize the soothing nature of it. It makes me feel healthy. I recognize that, and I recognize that my mind is being pointed in a healthy direction. Okay. So this purposefulness element of mindfulness is the ball game. You know, it's the, okay, I'm at the stoplight, I can feel it coming up. This is taking me to the wrong place. This is going to cause me and my grandson to suffer. Okay. There's a recognition inherent in the mindfulness. So that's a training of the mind. And it's the reason we do this sitting, start being able to discern a thought from an emotion, discerning different kinds of energies from each other, and then discerning which way those point the mind. When it feels that way, you know that it's pointing the mind in an unhealthy direction. You pull that part out, I mean, what is the value of mindfulness? It's very pleasant. You're probably much more aware. But if you pull out, where is this taking me? You don't know where it's taking you. Because, you know, it's back to the Socrates quote. Okay? You have an idea, you know, you're not even going to know it if you find it. So, okay, so then, I just want to comment on two things real quickly. And there are two conditions that support and are really critical, in my opinion, to using your attention and mindfulness in this particular way. And so the first one is adopting a stance of basically not knowing. You know, your beginner's mind or not knowing mind and what have you. And while we've all heard this and it all sounds very quaint and nice, you know, I would pose the question, when was the last time that you sat down before you started a sitting? And in any way at all, said to yourself or reminded yourself that in this sitting, I don't know what's going to happen. And that's the exciting part about it. You know, you used the word curiosity earlier. You're the only person. Well, that excites me when somebody's really curious about their mind and they're curious about suffering and about happiness. You know, without that element, without the real genuine curiosity, it's frequently hard to muster up energy. So this not knowing element is not something I think that, well, I think it gets lost. And it's critical because the fact that I don't know what's going to happen next is the thing that makes it exciting. And it's the thing that makes us want to observe in a particular way. See, we have to say first, you know, actually, in the way that I'm talking about it here, this fundamental Buddhist psychology, I don't know how and why I suffer most of the time. Most of the time I'm caught in my story. Most of the time I'm trying to figure out my reactivity. I'm not practicing in a way that takes me back to this core ground that if I could would really change the way I practice both walking, sitting, and in daily life. And I think part of it is that we don't want to believe that we don't know. We know intellectually that on the way home tonight, one of us may be in an automobile accident and die. Or tomorrow, one of us may wake up and I've been in perfect health most of my life, and all of a sudden I'm not in perfect health. It's pretty miserable. You know, I could just start making a list, right? Our minds are, I don't know if it's hardwired, but it's as close as you can get to defend against this notion that this is going to always happen to somebody else. So adopting this stance in meditation practice and in mindfulness runs against the Buddha said, against the stream of what our mind wants to believe and accept. That's part of the reason it's so difficult. And part of the reason it's so helpful, because if we could actually start developing this in our sitting meditation, undoubtedly it would have some impact on the rest of our life. Because if you've meditated even a little bit, you realize that everything you see when you're sitting are just reflections of the rest of your life. And any progress that you make in sitting meditation starts to just spontaneously, it's, you know, appear in other parts of your life as well. Okay. So I'm going to read just this very short thing here. And this is from the new issue of Tricycle magazine. And it's an article by Frank Ostaski, who, if you don't know this guy, he's amazing. He is the fellow who founded and has run the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco for years and years and years. And they have this extraordinary training, interdisciplinary, intertradition training. And this is an article entitled Washing My Boy's Body.
Watching my boy's what?
Washing my boy's body.
Oh, okay.
One day, and this is just the beginning of it. This is a fairly long article that I would encourage you to read. It's worth it. One day in the middle of writing a foundation report, I got a call from a man I didn't know. I'd never spoken with him before. He explained that he was the father of a 7-year-old boy who had been very ill with cancer. Some people had told him that I might be able to help him out. I said, certainly, I would be willing to help the family through their grieving process. I made some suggestions about how I might be able to support them when the time was right. The man paused. It was clear that I didn't understand yet what was happening. He practically whispered, no, Jamie died a half hour ago. We'd like to keep our boy at home in his bed for a while. Can you come over right now? Suddenly, the situation wasn't hypothetical. It was real and staring me in the face. I had never done anything like this before, which is pretty incredible, you know, because this guy has, you know, been running this hospice for, you know, years and years and years. Thousands of people that he's guided through this. But, you know, here's a situation where somebody he doesn't know, never talked to them, they call up, their boy has just died, and they want him to come over to their house right then, you know. Sure, I had sat at the bedside of people who were dying, but I had not attended the death of a young child with two grieving parents in unimaginable pain. I honestly had no idea what to do, so I let the fear and confusion arise. How could I possibly know in advance what was needed? So then the rest of the article is about what he did and what they did. It's just quite beautiful. But I think this last line is the line. How could I possibly know in advance what was needed? And while you say, well, sure, that's such a dramatic instance, how could you possibly know? I think that applies to when you sit down to meditate every time. How can I know what's going to be needed in this meditation? You sit down, it's all routine, right? I sit down, I know there's going to be a certain range of things. So there is a certain range of things because that's what my mind has framed the meditation experience as. Well, maybe I'll have really significant insights if I go on retreat. But during my daily practice, you know, so, well, there's the box. You know, it's all framed in. So I think whether it's daily meditation, whether it's getting up and what's going to happen today, what my next encounter with my grandson is, this who knows what actually is going to happen? Who knows what will actually be needed? How will I bring all of these tools to bear in a creative, alive way in life? In this living process, and that will be momentary, and that will be contingent. Because I'm not going to know until I get there. And once I get there, there's going to be a set of circumstances, and I'm not sure what they are, and I need to be flexible and adapt to them. Right? That's the cornerstone of Buddhist practice, is flexibility and adaptability. So I think this this notion of not knowing, I just don't know what's coming, and I don't know what will be needed, are really unbelievably healthy and helpful things to have more in the forefront of our mind and maybe be reminding ourselves. You know, some people do the daily recollections about, you know, the nature of my life is loss and death and all these things. You know, that's one thing. But that's a very programmed thing, right? This is, I just don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen today. I don't know what I'm going to need to do. And then that sets up the conditions in you to be watching for, well, what is happening? What do I need to do? How do I need to be creative? And then the second condition that seems to me to be absolutely critical, and we talked a little bit about this, is we frequently talk about seeing clearly. That's one of the interpretations of Vipassana. And what that really means is not just seeing. It's not just seeing, but it's seeing with purposefulness. Okay, it's seeing and understanding what I'm experiencing in its relationship to pain or suffering. I mean, if it was just like, well, all I want to do is see clearly, well, okay, I'll just go out and look at the trees and make sure that I see the bark real clearly. Okay? No, it's like, well, when you look at the bark, what experience do you have? You know, does a thought come up? Does a feeling in your body come up? And where does that take you? So seeing clearly and understanding as opposed to doing, I think, is the dichotomy, not being and doing. So when we use doing in kind of a pejorative sense in meditation practice, what we're talking about is striving, is trying to achieve or accomplish a specific thing. And so you say, well, geez, aren't we trying to develop compassion? And aren't we trying to develop the skill of seeing clearly? And aren't we well, of course we are. But the difference is in the moment of meditation, in the moment of walking meditation, in the moment of being with another person, with my grandchild, in that moment, what am I doing? Am I able to say, I don't know what's about to happen and I don't know what's going to be needed, so I'm wide open and I'm going to be mindful of what's happening in my body and my mind and respond accordingly? Or am I going to have some kind of pre-established, cooked up set of tools that I'm going to apply? So that I'm trying to be compassionate, where maybe compassion isn't the skill that's needed. Maybe what's needed is just patience and waiting, so that the emotionality of the situation settles, and then you can decide, what do I really need to bring to this? You know, we're jumping to the big thing first. You know, I need to be compassionate. Well, no, maybe the first thing you need to do is have a clear mind, so you can decide if compassion is what's needed. Okay. So, seeing and understanding that becomes the goal in any moment, so that you can make a choice, a wise choice as to what to do, as opposed to trying to achieve or do something. And as I said earlier, I think the value of that is that if we can do that, it opens up the space for us to see exactly what's there, rather than what we think is there, what we hope is there, or what we want to be there. Because it's easy if what's there is what we want to be there, or what we want to be there, because then we've got this pre-cooked response to manage and control the situation, and I can feel safe. And it frequently does not feel safe to say, I don't know. And I'm willing to just be here in this lack of knowing and open myself. It can be a very frightening thing to be very vulnerable. And it's the exciting thing, too, because once we start to learn how to do that, we develop a confidence and a trust in our capacity to respond skillfully. rather than having to rely on some skill of management or control. Management and control has all this rigidity to it, and a willingness to be open because I'm willing to trust and have confidence that I have the capacity because of my practice to respond skillfully. That's a totally different thing. That's a soft, embracing quality of mind. And we're never going to get away from making what we subsequently think are errors, because whether we're managing or controlling or whether we have enough confidence to do that, on both ends, sometimes we're going to do things that in retrospect we think weren't so good or we should have done it differently. So you can never escape that. That's the human dilemma, right? So the control management thing is an effort to prevent that from happening. Never make a mistake, you know. So these two things, the not knowing as a posture towards everything, and an acknowledgement of this reality, because if it's true, and you can test it, that everything is coming together momentarily and contingent, there's no way we can know. Possible. And there's no intellectual way you'll ever get out of that one. Not going to happen. You know. So it's a fundamental acknowledgement of reality. And it's the most skillful thing if what you actually want to do is practice. And then the second element of being devoted diligently, and actually I think kind of falling in love with, in the most positive sense of the term, of practicing to see and understand rather than to do something. These two things, of all the many, many things, but these two things are two of the core things that undermine using our attention and mindfulness in a really, really, really skillful way. Okay, so that's it. So a couple of quick comments or questions? We have a lot of...
I had a question for... In meditation, you were saying that, like, when you're in the car and you're getting mad and you notice it, and then you stay with it and you wait till the emotion passes and then you inquire as to what caused it to happen, the causes... In meditation, like, we were sitting earlier, I had, you know, a thought trigger, an unpleasant emotion, and my mind immediately wanted to know why, so I went into that, and then that triggered a whole bunch of them.
Right.
And I get caught up in, is that the time, or is would you wait till after the sitting to figure out, or in the sitting, are you just trying to be aware, or are you... See what I'm trying to say?
Sure. Okay. So the objective of the meditation process is a, you know, like when we say understand, once again, and this is tricky, and it shows where our mind wants to go. Where our mind wants to go is, I want to go to a content-based answer. I want to know the reason I'm feeling that is because something happened to me, and when we say understand, we mean back to this process of, like, how is this coming together and arising so that I'm feeling this, and that thought is coming up. Okay. So using the being at the parking lot or at the stoplight illustration, it's that you start to feel it, and then you open to it. Hopefully, fortunately, I did have to sit there for 5 stoplights because I wouldn't want to be doing this once the car started moving. Okay, but you feel this coming up in your body and you shift your full attention to the experience that's happening in the body, not the thought or content that you think is driving it, right? And just stay with that and do the kinds of things that we did in the beginning meditation class. And then one of two things will happen, either, hopefully, one is that it will completely dissipate. which it does on a surprising number of occasions. And the other thing, and probably equal number or more, the majority, is that the intensity of it, well, because you're not resisting it and you're not holding on, the whole intensity just drops, so that you're still feeling something, but it's down at a level where you can manage it very easily. So one of those two things, normally, you know, once you learn how to practice pretty well, will happen. And then there's sometimes the big ones, you know, where that'll all happen and it's not enough, you know. And then you've got to sit with it, and I think that having a good toolbox to explore, you know, the real-time, real-world implications of what's coming up in your relationships and other things is critical for overall. You know, we cannot, and it is unwise to think that this practice by itself is a panacea. Okay, you know, like, well, I'm going to meditate and I'm going to do walking meditation, and then, you know, I don't have to worry anymore about my relationships. They're just all going to take care. I mean, we just got to do like a ton of hard work, and sometimes it requires, you know, the help of a really good therapist. And there's a lot of mindful Buddhist-oriented therapists now. So this has its role, and a huge role. You know, this is a way of life. It's not treating a discrete problem, you know, with a therapeutic process. So ideally we develop this so it becomes a way of our living, and then all of these other tools really can get traction much more quickly.
More of a comment, when I heard you talking, it made me think that a lot of these skills and practices and stuff they're very human and kind of common sense throughout cultures and times and history. I think the Buddha really obviously systematized it and really looked at it really, really clearly. But so much of these, I feel like, actions and behaviors and etiquettes and mores and norms have just been historical. I mean, we've just learned as human beings, if you do this, you're going to hurt, and they're going to hurt, and pain's going to hurt. But nobody, you know, maybe, you know, it could be have some a religious umbrella, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or something. But a lot of it is very human, and that's why, even when I was doing the walking meditation, you know, sometimes when I do Buddhist practices, I think I'm doing Buddhist practices. It's very pious and spiritual. I was like, wait a minute, this is actually very mindfulness is a very human thing. It's just how our minds are and how they work. And it was nice, at least here today, and being reminded of that, and sort of hearing when you were talking about some of, you know, the cause and effect kind of thing. I feel like cultures throughout history that haven't even heard of Buddhism had sort of realized cause and effect to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think you're right. The things that maybe distinguish him a little bit are, you know, the way it's packaged. You know, he went way out of his way to avoid a lot of the things that trigger people. And while, you know, this became, you know, the fourth great religion, he was pretty clear that this was not religion. It was what you're saying, it's a way of life, right? You know? And then his emphasis on causation, I think, is a little unusual, you know, particularly to other, compared to other religious traditions. And his diminishing the value of content. And then the one thing that everybody pretty much agrees is unique to his teachings is this notion of this same whole causation, or, you know, coming together, applied to, you know, the next step, which is a whole other discussion, is that the other implication of that is that I'm using the language of momentary and contingent. The other way that you could describe that is the implication of that is that there isn't anything that is entirely separate and freestanding, you know, that everything is connected. And so his idea of anatta, or the absence of a completely separate and permanent self, which I think is largely misunderstood,
I think what I was trying to say was that if this is the way reality is and this is the way we are, then the Buddha illuminated that, but that's always percolating in us all the time anyway. So it's a human thing. So even somebody in Africa who's never even heard of this still has this reality, so bits and pieces of it are going to percolate up.
That's right.
And so to me it was that it's, and you, I feel like today, and you and the practice and the contemplations really helped reminded me in a really good way that, wait a minute, this is not a spiritual practice, it's a human, you know, it's about how reality works. Yeah. And I think sometimes when I sit down to meditate, I feel like I'm doing this thing, you know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you for saying that, because that is right, and that it's, everyone has that potential, and you know, the Buddha was also clear that he didn't create anything.
Right.
Right? You know, that he was merely describing what already was there. So.
And how could we not have glimpses of that regardless?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you. Okay, so I'm going to make one comment, and then we'll close with a short metta. You know, all of this, I think this practice is a difficult practice. Because like this element right here really does run against the way we normally think and the way we are normally looking at things, and that's the reason that it requires a training of the mind. One of the what they call paramis or perfections, there these 10 qualities of mind that are considered critical to freeing the mind, is what's called right resolve. And right resolve is associated with the idea of aligning your conduct and your thoughts and emotions with your intentions. You know, so Gandhi said the goal is for what we think, what we say, what we do, to be in harmony. You know, that we're actually implementing intention. So, you know, it requires, that really requires some effort, because on this attention thing, we're lapsing so much. So, with metta, I think this is such a clear illustration of that. Because the Buddha said that if you actually lived in an intentional community, that both internally and externally, that you should be thinking thoughts of metta towards other members of the community internally, and then expressing that externally all the time. That should be your goal. That's your intention, and then that's what you're doing. So that would mean that, not just that there's someone that I'm having difficulty or that I find unpleasant in the Sangha, and I do metta towards them, you know, and when I'm around them, I act nice. But internally, when I see them, I actually think thoughts of kindness and compassion about them, and that I try to generate internally, you know, emotions, and that I try to have a relationship in my own mind of this kind of friendliness with them. Okay. So that would be an illustration of right resolve as applied to metta. Okay. So I'd just like to do just a really short closing metta, trying to use that as a model, that there are internal elements. There's what we think, our emotions, and our internal relationship with other people. And then there's our external behavior, right? There's what we say, what we do, and the actual physical presence that I hold. You know, you don't have to say something or do something for someone to feel like you're hostile towards them, right? So it's that piece. So I'm just going to try to apply that very simply to a short metta. So, just find a position that is comfortable. And we've had a lot of words and ideas, so see if you can just allow your awareness to move back into your breath and your body. And feel the weight of your body in the chair or the floor, and points of contact, and the breath moving in and out of the body, and just allowing any thinking or thoughts to begin to recede into the background. And so when we leave here today, we'll encounter others in our home or in the grocery store or other locations. And as best we can, setting an intention where we will hold thoughts and emotions and an internal relationship with others that will allow them to feel safe and protected in our presence. And to set an intention that the way we will speak and act and the very presence of how we hold ourselves with others will support them in feeling safe and protected in the world. And so may we think and feel and establish an inner relationship and speak and act and hold a presence that allows those we come in contact with to feel supported in being as healthy and as strong as they can be, being peaceful and happy, and experiencing some sense of ease in living and in their contact with us. And may each of us and all of those that we hold dear and all of the people on this planet, and I think this includes everyone who is suffering, it's only a question of degree, and then beyond our planet, the extraordinarily large universe that we live in, whatever beings of whatever kind may exist, may all of us be free from suffering and experience a life with some true measure of satisfaction and happiness. Thank you very much for coming.